Needless to say, there were no more questions. I'm very pleased to be able to introduce William Macnes,
the
Senior Vice President, Chief Economist for Bank of Nova Scotia. He regularly acts as an advisor to government, including a recent assignment as a special policy advisor to the Honorable Michael Wilson, Minister of Finance. Lord, let us hope he prevails. Mr. Macnes is a member of the Board of Trustees of the Fraser Institute and is a past member of the Ontario Economic Council. Before joining the financial community, Mr. Macnes spent several years as a senior advisor to the Department of Finance in Ottawa. And during his years in Ottawa, he served as Canadian representative of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, and similarly in International Monetary Fund consultations with Canada.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies, gentlemen, I'm pleased to be here and delighted to be a guest at this proceeding. Very, very delightful day so far, and let me see if I can make some contribution here. I've selected a short and eclectic set of items that I'll touch on, depending on how I can manage my time and talk through all of them here. I thought I'd start out with some comments on tax reform. Move on to the issue of spending control.
Does he want it backwards? Does he want it any rule backwards?
And thereafter, I would move on to the fiscal sector in North America. For those who like to worry, that's the area to concentrate. We're going to have a disaster. Quite predictably, the spring and source, not for our lack of sophistication and extraction of revenue. Finally, I'll touch on the free trade issue, which I believe is a much tougher and much more visceral issue than is commonly perceived, and Canada has some very special risks in this regard. Through the course of these remarks, I think we'll see a thread of making an effort to look beyond cash flow problems, the immediate dimension, look more to the balance sheet situation. I believe that our public policy makers in Ottawa have two debilities. I think they're instinctively interventionists, and that's certainly not my line of card. I believe also, though, that they really do stop the analysis at the end of the first round of cash flow and tend to wake up looking at balance sheet situations that have really run far out of control and literally beyond their capacity to retrieve the situation. I'll also make some remarks and Glenn's comment with respect to the matter of transfer payments. I think transfer income redistribution in Canada has become the great addiction. If there were an epidemic here, I'm not so sure that it's drugs, but I certainly think our proclivity toward income redistribution, I think, is indeed an epidemic. I think it's the financial equivalent of a social disease. On the matter of tax reform, I believe that it is easy to exaggerate the potential benefits of running a more sophisticated extraction system. For those who had to wade through this whole area from grad school and as I spent enough years in Ottawa, too. Basically, you get no end of highfalutin theory running around the efficiency of the system and the neutrality and the fairness and so on. I think the bottom line is, as Sally Pipes indicated, really, how much is the government spending? That's really the issue. You see, it begs the question in a country like this where the government is now appropriating more than 50% of everything that's produced to seriously maintain that you can run an efficient extraction system. I mean, everyone with even well into the double-digit IQ range is going to pick up on this pretty quickly, and you won't get a lot of cooperation when on average you're removing 50% of what individuals are producing. You tend to get a very blocky system that way. So it's nice to talk about an efficient system,
But literally, it's, I think, the equivalent of pulling teeth without anesthetic. People just don't put up with it or stand still for it at all. Similarly, the whole idea, I believe, of neutrality and fairness in a tax system extracting that much is just an absolutely ludicrous proposition. Let me touch on the issue of marginal tax rates. I'd be somewhat ambiguous here. I wouldn't want to be boxed into the position of being in favor of 90% marginal rates and so on. However, as a practical matter, the very high marginal rates have never been enforced anyway. I think it gives you a more elegant system if you can move the rates down, and I think it looks a lot better on paper. I'm not sure that I'd personally pay a great deal of money for the transition to the system. And another caveat that's very important, there may be more of a case in the United States, because in that country, the public sector takes about 37% of GNP, so that it really, to tell anyone that he has a marginal tax rate less than 37% probably doesn't help him a great deal, because unless he's basically breaking the law or living offshore, one way or the other, the minimum you're going to be hit at anywhere near the upper end of the system is a 37% rate across the board. In Canada, it's even more difficult, you see. On average, Canadian taxpayers or those who produce the product have to pony up 50% of the government. It also flies in the face of the whole idea in this country of having a progressive tax system. If the average tax take has to be 50%, the arithmetic is quite straightforward. You have to run progression about 50%, from 25 to 75 might be a range of progressive tax rates, and that's a great theory, but try and collect the 75%. I think basically everyone just sort of muddles down one way or the other somewhere pretty close to 50%. Another major issue on tax reform is the question of income versus consumption. This is a subtle issue, and I think it's very important. As things are shaping up in the United States now, basically, it looks to me that there will not be a move toward consumption taxes for a reason that I'll touch on later. At the outset, basic economics, I believe, are very persuasive that a tax on consumption is a superior device when you're in a high-tax environment. In a high-tax environment, round one taxing income says that the market doesn't get a chance to determine how much of that income is allocated to consumption and how much to investment. So basically, you frustrate the investment function if you're chopping the income up front. At least if you put the tax system biting in at the consumption level, the decision and the choice between consumption and investment has already been made. I think it's a very powerful argument for knocking it off on taxation of income and relying more on consumption. Without becoming overly technical, moving the tax burden in the United States up on corporations is a fair approximation of consumption tax anyway, because it is passed through. The main reason I believe that Americans are inclined to avoid a consumption tax is that, first of all, they can afford it, because the public sector in that country is substantially smaller. There is no question we will have a consumption tax in Canada. I mean, our spending levels here absolutely demand it. It's the one sure bet the tax game. Now, in the United States, the choice, I think, to stay away from consumption taxes also represents a broader strategy in taxation. It's that a good way to control public spending is to keep a lid on how much the tax system produces. Well, that's a theory that I use to subscribe to. And I think I would, at this point, say that probably we Canadians are a little better judge of that theory than our American friends, because we've been in the soup a lot longer. And the fact of the matter is that putting a lid on the amount of money coming out of the tax system doesn't really work. At least in the Canadian experience, it absolutely didn't. We really hit the upper limits of taxation in the mid-70s.
basically the system's been not very productive there forward. We kept on spending, we reduced the deficits. I believe that's what's going on in the United States too, and it will lead me into the next issue here that I care to deal with, namely the deficits issue. I know that Milton Friedman wrote very powerfully on the basic idea: if you put a lid on the tax system, the amount of money coming out of it, you will ultimately control the spending. I think empirical evidence is otherwise, and it leads really to the conclusion that if we're going to maintain free markets, the democratic institutions that rely on
something,
I believe that it will be necessary change our basic legislative system such that there is an absolute legislative limit placed on the spending side, as opposed to attempting to go at it on the tax side. I believe that deficit finance has basically completely undermined the whole democratic represent government, the whole idea being to control the purse strings, and essentially with the advent of modern financial markets, is that governments have found a way, literally, to spend far in excess of anything that the electorate would put up with if they were actually taxed for it. I think the culprit here is deficit finance, and I believe that as a practical matter, we'll ultimately, if we cope with it, be driven to take a direct route of legislatively prohibiting the practice of deficit finance and making our elected representatives directly responsible for taxing us directly for everything that they're spending, as opposed to attempting to tighten the system with some fast-moving paper. I'm not sure that we're going to have to wait all that long for some of these issues to come to a head. Let me briefly describe my view of the overall fiscal dilemma in North America. The Keynesians were right that you really can juice up the economy by spending more than you take in, and certainly the World War II experience, I think, was that more. The problem is that that's really very much a cash flow type analysis, and the issue is that it works for what. The problem is that you're building up debt loads in the process. And I believe that that's the great limiting factor on progress in the international trade area, in domestic economies, and I believe that the buildup of debt is ultimately moving toward a position where it is literally becoming the weak link whole system, and literally the threat of free markets, the threat of the institutions that depend on those markets. Without becoming overly technical, at this time in Canada, we're spending about 40% more than we're taking in. If my memory serves me, in the United States, governments are spending about 30% more than they're taking in. That, I think, probably encapsulates the ongoing cash flow dynamic of the situation. Here's the problem. We're more advanced in this dilemma than the United States. We've been running big deficits for a decade. We now have an absolutely crushing debt load, which is taking more than one-third of current revenues just to pay the interest, not to pay any principal. Now, moreover, we have moved to the position where our deficits are, in a structural and chronic sense, are so large that they are impelling the rate of growth of debt in both Canada and the United States to move forward at a rate much in advance of the rate of growth of the economy. In Canada, we're still running between 2 and 3%, or pardon me, 2 and 3 times as rapid a growth of the public debt outstanding as compared to the rate of growth of the economy, or namely the tax base to pay this debt with. Now, both governments have, I think, bought a very poor a policy response. They basically contracted for a policy of gradual. And in the United States, the rough arithmetic is, I believe, in fiscal 87, you'll hit a crossover, where the rate, the deficit, which is impelling the rate of growth of debt, and the rate of growth of debt finally slows down to the rate of growth of the economy. Now, that hasn't improved anything. It just says things are going to stop getting worse. That's if you get the deficit of $140 billion by fiscal 87. In this country, we're strung out further than that. If you believe the official projections, 1990-91 would be the crossover point in Canada, where we would finally get the rate of growth of debt down to the rate of growth of the economy. The debt relative to the GNP between now and the end of the decade, on official projections, will grow from about 45% of GNP up to something in the order of 70% of GNP. Well, what it says is that we've contracted to keep the rate of growth of debt growing well in excess of the economy, basically on to the end of the decade. Now, that, first of all, I think is a mad proposition to start with. Moreover, it's an extremely high-risk proposition, because I think if you were a bet in that sooner or later the business cycle would be when it does, I think, literally in a fiscal sense, all hell would break loose. A recession in North America in the near term would drive the U.S. deficit to $300 billion, probably so fast that it wouldn't register on the way through. In this country, you'd be into a similar jackpot overnight. Another way this situation is, I think, undermining all its qualities is as follows. We are now into a situation where our policymakers are literally debt-driven in determining their policies. Basically, at this stage of the game, the debt overhang in the public sector and in the corporate sector, for that matter, and in the banking sector, is that literally the system would not survive a recession in the near term. Ergo, pushing on monetary strength. Now, the short-term goal of heading off the recession is that, of course, is not a normal course in business cycle developments in the market work. It's an extremely dangerous goal. So I think an optimist would have to say the odds are often close to even in this situation is likely to come unstuck before it is going to get better. He makes some very big comments on the future, which I'll leave off. I find on the free trade side that the immense imbalances in trade that have built up in the 1980s, I think, literally do threaten a return of the problems in the 1930s. The floating exchange rate experiment has been an unmitigated disaster. Floating exchange rates, in combination with the rise of major trading companies, has simply provided both the incentive and the capacity for major countries and major trading blocs to impose increasingly unfair trade practices. At the risk of oversimplification, the subsidies and all the modern monetary barriers are not products that originated in North America. From Europe, and the East, have gone too far. North America, I believe, is running out very rapidly. Canada is extremely awkward in this position. We found ourselves skated into the position of being the only industrial country without a free access market size. Moreover, our principal trading partner is very serious with merchandise. That's why I believe it is absolutely imperative I think that it's high time to stop the nonsense of talking of agriculture and services, highly contentious areas, areas that have not worked in terms of free trade on the record in Europe, 30 years experience. However, what has worked very well in conventional narrow free trade agreement to manufacture goods industrial goods. That's where I think we have a relatively easy proposition to put a deal together there. And once you move off agricultural services, you get the detractor both sides of the border shunted out of the debate. You can get on within a tight time system to get the job done. And make a closing comment to the Saudis. The biggest risk to my calculation in putting the deal together is we have to have joint determination. This is not to roll back U.S. trade remedy legislation. Are not to take away the sovereignty of the United States. However, you cannot have a bilateral deal in which one partner, and indeed by far the largest partner, reserves to itself the right to unilaterally resolve disputes and to apply remedies unilaterally. I think I will close there. Thank you very much.
Well, one would have to say after these wonderfully optimistic forecasts that there is one aphorism that still stands, and that is if you're going to live in a free society, you better maintain a great sense of humor. We will have time for questions from the floor, but first I want to call on Bruce, who has been squirming around here because he apparently wishes to either raise a few questions or maybe better words retaliate. I'm not sure. Bruce, would you like to... I didn't realize Dave's not a member of the association. But in all seriousness, I couldn't possibly disagree with most of what William just said. Some of my disagreements are political and some are theoretical. I mean, the notion that the corporate tax, the consumption tax, is quite theoretical literature that the corporate tax is a tax on capital that's paid almost exclusively by the shareholders. Say it's a consumption tax. But any, the idea that high marginal tax rates, if you have sufficient deductions and credits to lower the average tax rate, therefore means they have no impact, which I also heard him say, is also absolutely nonsensical. Excess burden taxation was created by high marginal tax rates. You pay not only the tax itself, but you have to pay an additional tax in the form of production that is not known because of those rates. And it's perhaps a little easier to see in terms of, say, a tariff. A tariff can be so high that it essentially keeps out goods that would have otherwise been imported at a lower price. So you have a burden of tariff, but the excess burden as well, goods that were kept out of the country. Now, lastly, on this whole business about deficit spending, this is an argument that has been going on for quite a long time in the States. And therefore, so Dave Stockman, I think, represents this point of view very clearly. It's based on cash flow analysis. It says if you can't cut spending, then basically you just have to cut the taxes because the debt burden will create some kind of economic chaos in the future. It's quite terrible. But and also, I think that he misphrased it. This interprets what Milton Friedman said. Friedman did not say, although some people have, that you must keep taxes down because he puts pressure on the government. In fact, what he said was somewhat the opposite. He said governments will simply always spend what they have. So higher taxes always fuel higher spending. It's a shimmer, I think, that you can balance the budget. Even if we all agree that balancing the budget is a good idea, and even if you agree to some principle that would be that raising the revenues in some way, shape, or form, or to balance it might be better than running up debt, you still can't do it because they will increase spending over and above that. You will have a continuous ratcheting effect, which is exactly what you've had most in the rest of the European countries and to a certain extent here. If you go back to the early 1960s, you find that the burden of government and taxation in the European countries was about what it is in the United States today. And then they put in the value added tax, a very insidious tax, because people don't see it. It's hidden in the prices of goods. And the increase in the amount of value added tax that's derived from various countries matches almost dollar for dollar of additional spending. So it's just foolish to think that that's even a trade-off. It's simply not viable. The only viable option is, in fact, to cut spending. But if you encounter a situation, as we have in many countries, where you can't cut spending, that's where it's become
inordinately difficult to do so. This does not in any way, shape, or form suggest the idea that higher revenues are an option. That's simply not an option. And I think it's extremely dangerous to even suggest that idea. And that's why Dave Stockman belongs in the doghouse where he would. I hope he stayed.